1,700 miles southeast of Hell's Canyon, day had long since dawned. The dome of sky was a solid mass of sulfurous, low-hanging clouds. The heat and humidity lay over everything in a stifling blanket. Moss-draped trees, cypress, pecan, spreading oak, and elm, framed either side of the Chemrain-eroded, two-lane blacktop. Strangler vines spiraled around thick trunks, climbing toward the hazy sun. Greasy-looking, red-headed buzzards sat perched in the highest branches of the canopy, their wings spread out to soak up the withering heat. Here and there between the stands of trees, Mildred caught the sullen glint of coffee and cream-colored standing water. The air hung thick with the stench of decay, both vegetative and animal. When the companions were well beyond the redoubt's sec perimeter, they unhooded their prisoners.
Welcome to Louisiana.
Whoa! Not possible. Couldn't be.
But Spru's eyes, nose, ears, and skin told him it was.
I don't know what you did or how you did it, but this is amazing.
Let's get a move on. We're exposed here.
They were back in Jack's old stomping grounds again, not far from Interstate 10, which had once connected the southern United States from coast to coast. For much of its length, the pre-dark highway was just a ghostly shadow across the landscape, a ribbon-like imprint only visible from elevation. Unusable for its original intended purpose, it had vanished entirely in some areas. As they moved through the steamy air, they dripped with sweat. Half a mile farther on, the pancake flat roadway was gapped by a wide brown river. Pink azaleas dotted the muddy banks.
How deep do you think, Ryan?
Too deep to wade.
Then Jack waved at them from downriver. When they joined him, he showed them a pair of crude dugout canoes tucked under the brush along the bank.
Figures the locals would have a way to cross it.
We can't all fit in those canoes. It's going to take two trips.
Three can go in each boat. Christy and Doc take Junior, and JB and Mildred take Spru. After you reach the far side, JB can paddle back to get me and Jack.
The companions put their prisoners amidships and set off across the sluggishly flowing river. Mildred paddled in the bow of the second canoe. Even on the water, the air was oppressively still.
Hellfire! Over there!
Mildred looked where he was pointing his paddle. Upriver, the shallows erupted. Amid splashes and swirls, a pair of gators launched themselves from the shoreline. Big ones, about 15 feet long. They glided downstream with the current, then swung into the wake 25 feet behind Mildred's canoe, lazily following with slow, sinuous sweeps of their tails. They weren't hungry, just curious. The alligators lost interest when the companions reached the opposite bank and beached the canoes. While JB turned back to pick up the others, Mildred, Doc, and Christy stood lookout and guarded the prisoners seated on the muddy shore.
You don't look so good, sweet cheeks. It's coming on you, ain't it? You're getting the itch.
What it is damned hot, and there's too damn many bugs. Ugh.
Mildred smacked a mosquito the size of a quarter, leaving a splatter of red on her sweat-beaded brown forearm. Junior licked his lips with a gray-coated tongue, unable to take his eyes off the blood smear.
Yeah, sure. Oozies ain't pouring into your brain. It's just the humidity.
Screw you.
When JB returned from the other side of the river with Ryan and Jack, they set off again along the pre-dark roadbed. Brown water stretched off in all directions, dotted here and there by stubborn, rotting remnants of drowned jungle. Ahead, on the horizon, was what looked like an earthen berm, only it was string straight and ran for miles.
Levy, highway on the other side.
Although the companions had visited the albino teen's birthplace several weeks earlier, Jack had no desire to revisit West Lowellton. There was nothing left there for him, no loved ones or close friends, just bad memories. The companions moved through swampy, knee-deep water, from tree clump to tree clump. They kept their eyes open, watching for snakes among the looping roots and hostile movement along the upraised strip of land. When they reached the levee, they climbed it, fighting their way through a snarl of underbrush. From the top of the dike, they surveyed the ruined highway. To the east, it was clear for perhaps 150 yards before doglegging to the left. 50 yards to the west, a concrete overpass had collapsed across the road. The impact had reduced it to a jumble of massive blocks sprouting twisted, rusting spikes of rebar. The blistered metal sign that had once decorated the overpass lay propped up against one of the larger chunks. White letters on green, Interstate 10.
Which way to La Golondrina, Kenny?
Not gonna say. Not until you feed me.
Don't tell us and you'll starve. I guarantee it.
We go west a ways on this road, then head south down to the Gulf of Mex.
The companions skidded down onto the roadbed, then trudged toward the fallen overpass. They weren't going to have to climb over it. Wag convoys had already cleared a wide gap in the dropped slabs.
Dead and over there.
A body floated face down in a water-filled ditch at the edge of the disintegrating tarmac. Above it, fat black flies buzzed in an ever-shifting cloud. The red plaid shirt and dark pants were stretched to the splitting point by the gas-bloated flesh beneath.
A whopper.
No!
Junior broke free from Mildred's grasp and lunged for the ditch. Ryan caught him by the arm before he got there and dragged him back, kicking.
By the three Kennedys! Look there!
Duck pointed his ebony sword stick at the road behind them. The companions turned as one. A 2-ton flatbed wag rounded the near bend and hurtled toward them along the shoulder of the highway. The cab and the wag bed were crammed to overflowing with dark figures. Human figures. But given the circumstances that cannies were flocking to La Golondrina, probably not norm figures. Before Junior could make a sound, Jack stepped up and punched him straight in the face. Dropping him hard on his behind.
Cut Spru's hands free, JB. Give him back his blasters, Christy.
The flatbed wag sent up a swirling cloud of dust as it roared along the ruined highway shoulder. Christy, Doc, Mildred, and Spruce scattered for cover among the jumble of fractured concrete blocks, taking up firing positions on either side of the breach. Jack grabbed hold of the dazed Junior and dragged him by the collar through the gap to the far side of the barrier. He quickly tossed the sack over the canny's head and cinched it closed. Then, pinning the canny face down with a knee, he tied his ankles together so he couldn't wander off. As the wag closed on the fallen overpass, Ryan jumped up on a slab of concrete and started waving his arms for it to stop. His hands were empty. His long blaster was slung, his Sig Sauer tucked in its holster. The one-eyed man smiled as he waved. He was just another canny brother, looking for a free ride. Bouncing over the ruts, the oncoming flatbed didn't slow down. The dented wag had once been light blue. Now it was mostly rust-colored. Its headlights were held on with overlapping strips of silver duct tape. Its front bumper and grille were missing. The buckled hood was held shut with loops of baling wire. Through the cracked, dirty windshield, Ryan counted 6 bodies crammed into the cab. The cannies were sitting on one another's laps. One of them half hung out the open passenger side window. In the wag bed were at least 20 more cannies. A bunch stood clustered behind the cab, looking over the roof at him. They all had blasters, but they weren't taking aim. Not yet, at least. The driver slammed on the wag's brakes. Dust thrown up by the locked rear wheels rained on the bed's occupants. The wag came to a stop below and to the left of where Ryan stood. The driver leaned out the window. He was grizzled, weepy-eyed, with snaggly yellow teeth.
We're full up. Can't squeeze in another body.
Then let's make some room.
JB popped up over the top of a concrete slab right beside the wag. Cut loose with his 12-gauge as he broad-jumped the distance between slab and wag hood. His first blast spiderwebbed the windshield in front of the driver. Overlaid patterns of double-aught buckshot blew out the windshield from right to left. They also blew out the cab's rear window. The cannies inside died where they sat, their heads exploding, torsos ripped by dozens of .31-caliber lead balls. Before the stunt cannies in the back of the wag could bring weapons to bear, Christy, Doc, Mildred, and Sprue opened fire with their hand blasters. As bodies toppled, some where they stood, some falling from the bed and crashing limply to the ground, the survivors jumped down to the road and took off in a full sprint, back the way they had come. Jack rushed through the gap and brought up his Colt Python in a two-handed grip. He squeezed off a single, carefully aimed shot. The Magnum slug hit one of the running targets at 50 yards, taking the canny down in mid-stride, driving him into the dirt. Jack's next 2 shots went wide.
Too far for hand blaster.
Ryan had already figured that out. Scrambling higher on the rubble pile, he shouldered his scoped long blaster. One by one, he nailed the madly dashing cannons, punching out 75 to 100 yards center torso kill shots. It finally dawned on the last pair of survivors that the road wasn't safe. As Ryan cycled to Steyr's bolt action, they darted over the levee. Crashing through the brush, they plunged headfirst into the brown water. Maybe they thought they could dive under the surface and make the sharpshooter miss, but the water only came up to their knees. When they dove in, their back still showed. .62 millimeter slugs slapped into wet fabric and warm flesh. The cannies thrashed their arms and legs, trying to swim or to stand or to breathe. Then they stopped moving. Both floated face down in spreading films of red. Transfer of the flatbed's ownership took less than 3 minutes, start to finish. Doc and JB pulled open the wag cab's doors, dragged the bodies out of the cab, and dumped them unceremoniously on the ground. They stripped the coats from two of the stiffs and used them to sweep out the broken glass and wipe away the gore. Mildred, Christy, and Jack used their boot soles to propel the bodies off the rear of the wag bed. That done, Jack went back to retrieve Junior. He untied the canny's ankles, jerked him to his feet, and shoved him forward.
Hitch him to one of the eye bolts.
Ryan slipped in behind the idling wag steering wheel and shut the driver's door.
Take that blindfold off. Junior needs to see so he can tell us where to make the turn.
Sprue pulled off the grain sack hood and pointed at the tangle of corpses lying around the wag.
Who are they?
Pilgrims. On their way to La Golondrina to get the cure.
How do you know that?
They were all last gaspers. Otherwise, they would have put up a better fight.
It'd be hard to put up worse.
Shoot. Piss poor.
Mildred and Christy jumped down from the bed and joined Ryan on the cab's bench seat.
It's gonna be mighty breezy without a windshield.
Maybe it'll blow out some of the stink.
The wag's steering was sloppy, its front suspension shot. There was no speedometer, just a round hole in the dash where it had been ripped out. The fuel or oil pressure gauges were missing too. None of that mattered to Ryan. He planned to drive until the wag ran out of gas or oil. Then they would dump it and continue on foot. Sprue leaned down through the broken rear window.
Big wag still using this road. Can tell by all the fresh ruts.
You mean wags like this?
No, I mean semis and 6x6s in convoys.
What traders would be dumb enough to try to do business in canny country?
Not norms, that's for sure.
Cannies are organizing their own transport?
Gotta be.
Doing on the fly road maintenance, too. Filling in the deep axle-busting holes with rock as they go. Digging ditch drains to bleed off standing water.
Gaia, what are they up to?
No one had an answer to that. If Junior knew why, he kept mum, despite Spru's well-placed kicks.
Oh, fuck me!
Ryan drove west along Interstate 10, stopping the wag in front of a Holiday Inn. The single-story, white, American colonial-style building had been set on fire at some point, but hadn't completely burned. It had lost its roof. The hotel swimming pool, once overgrown with bougainvillea and azalea creepers, had been cleared of vegetation. Now, human bones, bleached white by the sun, lined the long rectangle.
Bones could be from the neutron strike.
There aren't any skulls. I see ribs and long bones, but no skulls.
There were no live folks inside either. But there were animals. A quartet of scrawny, timid pigs ducked into one of the roofless, doorless rooms. Chickens pecked for bugs along the edge of the bougainvillea. A ram sheep stood watching them from the collapsed portico.
You canny bastards never eat livestock? Not even in a pinch?
Shit, they give us the triple squats. Sometimes we chew them for fun.
Ryan drove on through the wasted landscape. On a low hill, surrounded by water, was a cemetery. All the above-ground crypts had been broken open, the bodies taken. Cannies built nothing, Ryan thought. They grew nothing. They were exclusively human predators. Sooner or later, there would be nothing left for them to eat. They would have to move on or truck in their food. Ryan couldn't guess where the supply chain was coming from, but he had no doubt what it was carrying. It was early afternoon. The sun still hadn't come out, but the air temperature was well over 100 degrees. Even with the steady breeze through the missing windshield, it was sweltering. Ryan, Christy, and Mildred sweated into the bench seat. Perspiration dripped from their chins and rolled down their arms and legs. At Mildred's prompting, they sipped from a water bottle and swallowed a few salt tablets. Doc, Jack, Dix, Junior, and Sprue sat on the wag bed, their heads lowered, breathing shallowly. With the 10-foot-tall walls of briar, mangrove, and brambles bordering the sides of the road, it was like driving in a green ditch. There was no way to tell how far the scrubland stretched to the east and west, or whether it was broken by swamp or drowned in sinkholes. The road ahead was flat and straight all the way to the next turn, which was about a mile and a half away. As Ryan motored along, another wag popped into view around the distant bend and came barreling toward them.
Swamp buggy.
The wag had about 4 feet of ground clearance, thanks to its huge, knobby tires. The roof over the passenger compartment had been cut away, and there were lots of folks packed inside. Ryan spoke over his shoulder.
Get Junior up, quick. Who the fuck are they?
Direction they're coming. Looks like your brothers and sisters returning from their pilgrimage.
The distance between the converging wags narrowed rapidly.
We gonna chill them, Ryan?
Have to stop to do that. But if we stop, we risk having more Kennys roll up on us while we're wiping them out. I think at best we take another tack. Wave and smile. Just wave and smile.
The Chevy Blazer full of cured flesh eaters waved back as they zoomed by. The swamp buggy didn't slow down. It just kept on going. By that time, the flatbed was almost on top of the dogleg left. As Ryan braked for the turn, another much bigger wag appeared around the bend, traveling at high speed. He didn't have time to honk a greeting. The wind of its passing nearly whipped the flatbed off the road. Then the companion's wag was into the turn, and the monster wag was out of sight.
Damnation! What in God's name was that?
A belated trailer for hauling cattle. Pulled by a honking big tractor. It was running empty. Already dumped its load.
They're sure as shit not hauling cattle.
You got that right, Four Eyes. It's Long Pig for the big luau.
Shit. Well, that's it. No more gas. Guess we gotta walk from here. Let's get this thing off the road.
Ryan left the tranny in neutral and the emergency brake off. Jack untied Junior from the eye bolt and shoved him off the bed. Working together, the 7 non-cannies pushed the wag off the shoulder, nose first, into the bordering brush. There was water in there, or quicksand. The front end of the wag sank down over the windshield. The rear stuck up in the air.
How far do we have to go, Junior?
Maybe 15-20 miles.
Not enough daylight left to cover that much ground.
We'll go as far as we can, then slip into the boonies. Nasty spot to pitch camp, but we'll make do.
They left the wag and continued down the patched road. The air was blistering hot and dead still. Mosquitoes and no-see-ums swarmed around their heads. The companions couldn't move fast enough to escape them, and swatting soon became too much of an effort. In the space of an hour, 3 more wags drove by, coming up from the south. The drivers and passengers all waved. The companions waved back, each time growing more confident that they weren't going to be attacked by the occupants of passing wags. After all, this was canny country these days. No norm in his or her right mind would be out in the open, caught on a long, deserted stretch of road. It didn't hurt that they were dragging Junior behind. Seeing him all trussed up around a tree limb, the cannies driving by probably thought he was their dinner. Ahead, the road rose in a slight incline as it cut across a low dome of higher ground. The dirt under the tightly packed waist-high scrub looked dry. Again, there was no telling where the dry land ended and the surrounding swamp began. In the distance, everything was the same monotonous green. Jack had point. He moved quickly up the road, searching the bracketing stands of vegetation with his blood-red eyes, his ears pricked up to catch the slightest sound. Jack hand-signaled a halt. Something was very wrong.
Fan out.
Caught in a crossfire, bullets freight training over their heads, the companions dove for the only cover at hand, the wall of low brush beside the road. Junior tried to duck in after JP, but could only get his head and shoulders into the scrub. The stick thrust through his arms effectively held him out. Like a cork in a bottle, his body kept Mildred from following the others. She pulled the pole free, then booted him in ahead of her. The waist-high stunted trees were so thickly intertwined at their tops that she had to fall on hands and knees and crawl for her life. Volleys of slugs swept through the vegetation, clipping off leaves and small branches, raining down dust and fine debris. The disciples from the load above and below, they joined ranks to finish the job. Junior Thibodeau couldn't crawl for beans with his hands tied behind his back. Halting progress was slowing Mildred down big time. Fearing she would lose the companions in the stand of brambles, she reached up with the point of a sheath knife and deftly slid his bonds. Even though she and the canny were following the path Ryan and the others had made, the rowing was tough. The low, springy branches that sprouted from the skinny trunks blocked every foot of ground. They were too flexible to break off, and there was no room to swing a punga. It would have taken a chainsaw to clear the way. The companions had to twist over or around the branches to advance. The farther they got from the road, the more the land sloped downward. The ground got wetter and wetter, too. Mud soaked into their elbows, knees, and stomachs. Incoming fire gradually dwindled. After they had squirmed about 100 yards into the bush, the shooting stopped altogether.
Hold it.
Mildred turned to look over her shoulder. Behind her, the tree limbs had closed in like a door slamming shut. She could see less than a yard into the scrub. Weak daylight filtered through the mesh of branches overhead. Under the low-hanging canopy, it was like a bake oven. Mildred wiped away the cobwebs that clung to her face. There was dirt up her nose and in her mouth. Grit crunched between her back teeth. In front of her, Junior rolled onto his side. His shirt front was black with mud, and so were his pants. He had big holes in the soles of his boots. She could see the balls of his dirty feet.
Why would cannies be hunting the road on foot?
It made no sense. All the flesh-eaters and wags had driven past without giving the companions a second look. It was their turf, and they knew they'd already picked it clean.
What now?
We make them come in and get us.
Think they can track us down?
For sure. But to do that, they got to crawl on their bellies and meet us face to face.
We chill enough of them and they'll turn tail.
Then they heard a rustle of movement in the brush ahead of them, not behind, where they expected it.
We're boxed in. The bastards had a trail cut through the boonies parallel to the highway.
The companions squirmed into a fighting circle, boot soles at the center. JB rested his pump gun's barrel on a low limb. The others drew their blasters and braced their elbows for rapid fire.
Breathe through your noses. Don't waste ammo. Don't start shooting until you see them.
Nothing moved. Not even a leaf.
Give up, you Mardoan bastards! Give up right now and you'll die quick.
I know that kind of talk. That man is Cajun. I know that voice, too.
Fair enough! You had your chance. Now your cane is gonna die triple hard. Got buckets of big old black leeches saved up. Gonna shove them up your asses with a long wooden pole. Then we're gonna smoke some ganja, play some music. Watch why you devil dance yourselves to death.
Who is he, Jack?
Triple Mean. Stone ass chiller. Quick with blasting blade. Not miss.
Perhaps it is an appropriate time for you to get reacquainted with your old chum.
Cheetah Louise! That you?
You know my name, Flesh Eater.
Shoo! Sometimes I kick your scab ass. I stand up if you don't shoot.
Nobody shoot, hear me? Get on up, Kenny. Show yourself.
Jack rose from his knees, then struggled to thrust his head and shoulders through the scrub branches.
Ooh-ee. My oh my. Look at what we got here.
Hot as hell in the bush, Cheetah Louise. My friend, stand up now, too. Well,
come on ahead, then. But keep your blasters tucked away.
Mildred holstered her weapon, then pushed up through the crisscrossing branches. Dirty, tattered men and women stood lined up along the trail, well-worn assault rifles shouldered and aimed. They looked grim and impatient, but their leader seemed delighted.
Snow Wolf, I've been away. You too. Shitstorm going on down here now, man.
From Jack's description and the baritone voice, Mildred had expected someone more formidable-looking, more menacing. The Cajun was a skinny black man no taller than 5'8". He wore a little snap-brim hat on his head and a moth-eaten jaguar cape tied around his stringy neck. A crudely rolled cigarette dangled unlit from the corner of his mouth. Over his right shoulder, a machete hung on his back in a canvas sheath, and the holster under his left armpit was a hog-leg 45 caliber Smith & Wesson wheel gun. In one hand, he held a battle-scarred M16 with duct-taped back-to-back mags.
Been traveling some.
Cheetah Louise took the jumbo hand-rolled cig from between his lips, looked at its extinguished tip, then relit it with a wooden match. The pungent aroma wasn't tobacco.
You still smoking that fellow shit? Thought you'd give it up.
Helps me focus on the chili.
Cheetah Luis blew smoke out from between his clenched teeth. Then he turned to his firing squad and waved for them to lower their weapons.
This here's the Snow Wolf, for you who never met him. Y'all know what he done. How he fought off Baron Tamon with his little army. How he saved us from that cripple butcher. Heard he and his friends here cleaned up a mess a few weeks back. We owe him, if what I heard was true. Sweet girl told me you lit out after the chilling.
Had no reason to stay. Your people safe?
Nah. I came back from a hunting trip. Kane's got most of our people. Chased them down and ate them up. Wiped out man, woman, and child. Left the split bones piled up in their fire pits. When they was done eating, they burned down the homes out of pure cussed meanness. We chilled the bastards every chance we get. They hunt us, but we hunt them harder. We hunt them smarter. It's our daily chore. It's what we do. I wasn't fooling about them buckets of leeches neither. That's just the beginning when we get hold of a live one. When we catch canies, we hide them triple hard before we send them to hell. Nothing sweeter than seeing a bastard die slow.
Ryan glanced around.
Where's Junior?
Mildred quickly counted heads. There were 7 instead of 8. She and JB ducked under the brush for a look. Not that they could see very far. The canny wasn't there.
He's gone, damn it. Sneaked off into the bush when we stood up.
Who are you talking about?
We had a canny captive. We starved his ass and made him lead us here.
There he goes.
One of the black man's crew pointed at barely rustling treetops farther down the hill. Even though they turned to look, none of the Cajun fighters bothered to take aim.
Whew, don't fret about that one. Nothing but swamp in that direction. He might not come out neither. Can't he but smell like fresh baked bread to gator? If you need him, we can track him into morning.
Ryan nodded. Then the companions busted through the belt-high brush to reach the narrow path. As Mildred stepped out, Cheetah Luis's eyes lit up. He swept off his snap-brim hat.
Howdy do.
Been better, thanks.
Boss, we got company.
Cheetah Luis tore his gaze from Mildred's stocky figure. Even before she looked over her shoulder, Mildred heard the sound of multiple wag engines and the screech of brakes locking up. A canny convoy from the north had stopped on the highway behind them, and armed folk were jumping out of every wag.
2 minutes to fight. Got no surprise waking for us.
Slapping his natty hat back on top of his head, Cheetah Luis turned to Jack.
Y'all come on this way, Snow Wolf. We'll lose the bastards right quick.
The companions fell in behind the Cajun fighters as they hustled down the winding track. Before the cannies on the road could bracket them with fire, they ducked below the line of sight and squirmed into a tunnel bored into the brush. The entrance was well hidden by branches, invisible if a person didn't know exactly where to look. The path ahead had been cleared of springy branches, but was still so low that they had to move ahead on all fours. As they descended the slope, the roof of the tunnel rose overhead. The trees at the base of the hill were taller than those on the summit, but the branches were just as densely intergrown. Looking across the treetops from the road, the difference in height wasn't evident. Mildred scrambled to her feet. This trail had seen heavy use. Foot traffic had exposed the backs of tree roots. Spruce stumbled over one, but caught himself before he fell. For a big man, he moved well. The farther they went, the deeper the mud. They had to jump puddles of sour, standing water. The puddles grew wider, joined together, turned into ribbons and pools. Soon there was more water around them than land, and the land was isolated in little vine-choked islands. The Cajun called a halt in the middle of a shallow, leaf-littered pool. His giant cig had gone out again. His saliva stained the cigarette's paper yellow.
This is where the rubber leaves the road. Canis can't follow us through the deep water. You best unbuckle your gun belts and hold them over your heads. Y'all keep a tight sphincter now. Lots of hungry leeches in these swamps. Don't want none crawling up where the sun don't shine.
Cheetah Luis led the way, heading down a 5-foot-wide canal between the stands of tightly packed mangrove. Tepid water slid over their knees, then their waists. Sunlight streamed in through breaks in the canopy, lighting floating patches of bright green slime. Spanish moss draped the higher branches, trailing down to the water. The air hung heavy with the rotten egg smell of hydrogen sulfide. They were entering a fetid, malarial swamp. As they waited, insects hovered in dense clouds around their heads. They couldn't help but inhale the soft, fluttering bodies. Jack wiped a gob of black mud on his face and neck to keep the bugs off. The others followed suit. They slogged on for an hour without another break. It was too dangerous to stop. Time and again they saw huge gators sunning themselves on mud banks where the canopy gaped. The swamp wasn't quiet. Insects and gators weren't the only danger. Muddy water moccasins prowled among the exposed mangrove roots. 6 feet long, with gaping white mouths and long fangs, they swam just out of the traveler's reach, waiting for the chance to turn and strike. After another half hour of trekking, they walked out of the far side of the swamp onto a dry plain. The trees were more widely spaced, and mixed in were bursts of color, pink azaleas thriving along the banks of trickling creeks. The going was much easier, even though daylight was starting to fade. Mildred could see the Cajun's spirits lift. This was their domain. From a distance, the rounded hills looked like solid mounds of green. Only when they got close could they see the bone white of the bedrock peeking out from the tangled roots and sprouting vines.
"It's just us!"
From behind the tumbled-down limestone blocks, people rose, guns in hand. From bordering stands of tall trees, more armed sentries showed themselves. Cheetah Luis led the companions past them to an irregular opening in the hillside.
"Welcome to our hidey hole."
They stepped into the torchlit entrance. The original limestone cave had been extensively excavated, the work of many years. Wide galleries for sleeping, cooking, storage, and livestock had been hacked out of the living rock on either side of a central passage that stretched deep and straight into the hill. The Cajun gestured for the companions and Sprue to sit on benches carved into the walls. He took a place beside Mildred and lit up a fresh ganja stick.
"Why you come back here, Snow Wolf?"
"To chill like Golandrina."
"That's a tall order, even for you."
"How did she come to be here?"
"No one know for sure. Rumor is that she slipped in along the Gulf Coast a short time ago with a few other cannies. The pack started off raiding small fish camps and farms for meat. People just up and disappeared. Young'uns at first, then folks all ages. By the time we figured out what was going on, there were a lot more of them bastards hunting these parts. They come down here from the east, west, and north to join up with the bitch. When La Golondrina had collected herself a big enough crew, she set out business on Marsh Island, at the mouth of Vermilion Bay. There's a big old freighter wreck on the island's south shore. That's her headquarters."
"The canny who got away told us about some other bay."
"Westcote Blanche."
"Same thing, really. There's a little spit of land that divides the two. Closest way to Marsh Island is from Westcote Blanche."
"You fought from the beginning?"
"Yeah, yes, we fought them. We attacked the island with everything we had. Canis' firepower was much better than ours, and they had fortified the place. When we got up to the freighter, we couldn't make a dent in that steel hull. We lost a lot of good folks that night. After that, the Canis started driving deep into the countryside. We couldn't stop them. But they come ashore from Vermilion Bay to Atchafalaya Bay in canoes. Store horses to ride, or wags if they could get them. Chill poor folks and take their bodies back to the island to eat."
"You ever seen this Queen Canny in person?"
"If I had, I wouldn't be breeding now. I'd be a pile of shit drying in the sun."
"She hunt with the Cannies?"
"La Golondrina never goes off that island no more. Cannies come to her. Hundreds of them. We try to pick them off both coming and going, but they control most of the territory around here. Children ate just about everybody in sight."
"What do they use for food, then?"
"We saw the tar marks from heavy wags."
"Dem's the meat wags. Cannies are doing their hunting on pre-dark roads. They round up folks from a long ways off and truck them back here, live on the hoof. The bastards use semi-trailers. When they run out of tractors to haul the trailers, they hitch up teams of horses and cattle."
"Canny called it the Red Road."
Now that's the truth. Trailers go out full of canes, come back full of gnomes. Gnomes go to the island. They never leave.
How strong a force are you?
63.
Have to cheer the queen, friend. You help?
You're talking about suicide mission, Snow Wolf. No way to chill that bitch. She got herself too well protected.
You're just gonna let her whittle you down?
Better that than us dying all at once. Don't forget, we're whittling them down too. Making them pay for what they done. Taking our revenge.
For every can of you chill, 10 more gonna pop up.
How you figure that?
Ryan had no choice but to lay out the cards. He started with the Kenny Queen's cryogenesis.
The Golandrina's blood is what's drawing the Kennys here. The power of her blood. It can cure the Uzis for a while. Longer Kennys live, more Kennys there'll be. Simple as that.
All that freezy stuff is bullshit. I heard it before and don't believe it. She got no special powers. What she got is soldiers. Lots of them and lots of guns.
So you won't help?
Shit, no. We ain't no fools. We can't hide them no more. We're dead. I'm hungry. Let's eat.
At Luis's signal, other Cajuns carried in wooden platters heaped with long black sausages, fried okra, and stewed mustard greens.
I have never seen such sausages as these.
That's possum blood. Boudinois don't get no better than that. Okra and greens come from a garden we got hid out in the meadow.
The companions ate ravenously until they could hold no more. Soon afterward, exhaustion kicked in. Conversation ended. Eyelids drooped. Luis directed the companions toward one of the cave's communal sleeping chambers.
Time for you folks to take a rest. Plenty of room, make yourselves comfortable.
As Mildred walked past, Cheetah Luis pulled her aside.
I like my women nice and thick in the behind, just like you. Got me a big soft straw pallet way back in the cave. No one hears going at it if you're fussy about that. You're gonna love playing with my balls. They big as duck eggs.
Luis reached over and gave her right breast a pinch through her t-shirt. JB, who was watching the attempted seduction from the sleeping quarters entrance, unshouldered his pump gun. Mildred shook her head at him. This was something she could handle herself. She took hold of Cheetah Luis's hand and gently lifted it off her breast. With her thumb against his palm, she pressed her fingertips into the back of the hand, pinning nerves against unyielding bone. As if he were lightning struck, the Cajun dropped to his knees. Mildred kept the pressure on, not letting him break free of the grappling hold, twisting away as he tried to grab her, making him do a little pain dance on his knees. Around and around they went, the doctor hurting, the Cajun knee dancing. JB looked on uneasily as she reached to her belt for the handle of her sheathed knife. His expression of surprise and dismay snapped her back to reality. Despite the adrenaline coursing through her veins, she stopped herself before drawing the blade.
What I'm fussy about is getting mauled. You mess with me again, and I'll wear your duck egg balls for earrings.
Mildred flung his hand aside. Troubled, ominous dreams haunted Mildred's sleep. She ran down dark, winding hospital corridors, through slicks of congealed blood and piles of soiled septic bandages, past overturned gurneys and mounds of decaying, white-gowned bodies. All of the dead had been operated upon. Bristling rows of black stitches ringed their shaved heads, or zippered their loins from hip to hip, or divided their torsos, goobers to gullet. From the hall's doorways, wide-eyed, puffy-faced children Mildred couldn't save pleaded for their lives. Even lost in the nightmare, the symbolism was obvious to her. Failed medicine, failed science, failed civilization. The end of all hope. For the third time in what seemed like seconds, Mildred jerked wide awake, drenched with sweat. Her head throbbed as if it were going to burst. Her stomach felt queasy, and there was an awful bitter taste in her mouth. When she put the back of her hand to her forehead, it was on fire. With difficulty, Mildred forced herself to sit up on the lumpy, rag-stuffed mattress. A single torch lit the low-ceilinged Cajun sleeping chamber. On the other side of the dim, smoky room, Mildred could just make out Ryan and Christy cuddled in each other's arms on a stone bench. 6 feet apart, Doc and Sprue lay on their backs on the floor. JB was curled up on a straw pallet at her feet. Unwell in the midst of her trusted, oblivious companions, Mildred felt suddenly, utterly alone. The first stirrings of panic tickled deep in the back of her throat.
Is this how the Uzis start? Is it all downhill from here?
Gritting her teeth, Mildred forced her mind to clear. She made herself think like the trained physician she was. She followed that deeply ingrained scientific regimen. From the data at hand, she drew a set of objective, logical conclusions. That she had a fever was obvious. The cause was not. It could have come from any number of possible sources. A few drops of polluted swamp water could have gotten into her mouth. Some of the food the Cajuns had served could have been spoiled. It could have been an allergic reaction to all the insect bites she'd suffered. It could even have been the effect of head trauma. After all, she had been knocked unconscious twice in the space of a day. It all could have been.
How will I know when it's the Uzis and not just a bad case of swamp fever or ptomaine poisoning? How will I know when it's too late?
These were questions she wished she could have asked Junior Thibodeau. Not that she could have completely trusted his answers, but any information was better than what she had now. She leaned her forehead on her knees, trying to block out the stabbing pain behind her eyes. The cave walls and ceiling seemed to close in on her, first pressing against her skin, then compressing her ribcage, making it hard to breathe. She had to get some fresh air, or she was going to pass out. Mildred stepped around JB without waking him. Her knees felt rubbery and loose, as though they were about to give way under her. She staggered out of the cave entrance, into the sweltering night. She leaned back against the hillside's vine-draped bedrock, inhaling deeply, trying to slow her thudding heart.
Oh.
Adrenaline flooded Mildred's veins as she whirled toward the sound, her hand closed on her pistol butt. A pale, white-haired figure stepped closer.
Damn it, Jack, you scared me.
The albino didn't apologize, which was not unusual.
You're not sleeping either? Aren't you tired?
He either wasn't going to respond or he was collecting his thoughts. Mildred sagged against the bedrock, too exhausted to repeat the question.
Didn't want to come back after last time. I want to see this place again.
Bad memories fade sooner or later. Scars heal.
Not here. Nothing left here but bad. Good folks chilled or chased off by cannies. Farms burned. Levees busted. Swamp taken over.
Mildred was remembering in great detail her full-color nightmare. Her helplessness. The weight of her despair. Suddenly, she felt much, much worse. Hotter. Weaker. Jack's mane of white hair shimmered in front of her eyes, and she thought she was going to black out.
Water. You got water?
Jack passed her a plastic bottle, and she drank deep, trying to put out the fire in her chest. Then she splashed it inside her t-shirt and on top of her head. It cooled her and revived her. Was it her imagination, or was Jack looking at her strangely? It was hard to read those eyes of his, even in broad daylight. Perhaps he had noticed something odd in the way she moved or talked. Perhaps he was looking for early signs of the onset of the Great Death. She couldn't bring herself to tell him how terrible she felt as she passed the bottle back.
Hot night.
From the south, in the direction of the Gulf of Mexico, chain lightning crackled across the night sky. In the wake of the flash, Mildred noticed something odd. The dark belly of cloud was underlit by a subtle flickering. Orange, erratic, distant. She blinked her eyes, and it was still there. Worried that it might be an hallucination, a symptom of her advancing delirium, Mildred pointed it out to Jack.
What's going on over there?
Sea on fire.
What?
Leaks gas wells in the Gulf, 50-100 miles out. Fireballs all day and...
Mildred immediately sensed his tension. A chill rippled up her sweaty spine. Those ruby-red eyes of his could penetrate deep into the darkness, just like a cat's. Mildred's pulse began to pound.
What's wrong?
Jack didn't answer. Then she saw the Cajun sentries sprinting back through the trees, as if the devil was on their heels. Before Mildred and Jack could turn back for the cave, a flurry of rifle shots from the forest whined past them, slamming into the limestone slope at their backs, cutting off the retreat to the cave mouth. Canny fire. Two of the fleeing Cajun sentries were cut down in mid-stride as they crossed the clearing, their backs riddled with bullets. Jack grabbed Mildred's arm and pulled her away from the entrance. Powered by pure adrenaline surge, she ran hard on the albino's heels along the base of the hillside, sprinting for the cover of the bordering trees. Mildred drew her target pistol and skidded to a stop on the leafy carpet behind a tree trunk. She could see the winking muzzle flashes of the canny weapons. They were concentrated directly opposite the cave entrance. In the dim light, shadowy forms moved quickly through the woods around her. Not cannies, these were Cajuns. No longer in a panicked retreat, they were heading for already prepared defensive positions. From positions high in the trees and low around their bases, the Cajuns' crossfire would slow or turn back any canny advance across the open space. From the bunkers deeper in the trees, they were protecting the snipers' backs and stopping the cannies from encircling the clearing. As Cajun return fire clattered back through the woods, Jack took Mildred's hand and led her away from the tree. Keeping low, moving from trunk to trunk, they slipped deeper into the forest to meet the canny advance head-on. Suddenly, Jack stopped and dropped into a fighting crouch. Mildred knelt beside him. She strained to see ahead in the dark. The trees were black, the earth was black, the night sky veiled by leafy branches. Jack raised his Colt Python and prepared to fire. A moment later, Mildred saw the faintly reflected starlight, tracing the outlines of sweaty human faces and arms, moving toward them. A skirmish line of crab-crawling cannies. To her right, at the base of a tree perhaps 15 yards in front of them, something flashed silver. A long knife, a short sword. The pre-cut deadfall came down on the row of creeping cannies with a horrendous crash. It raised a cloud of dust and debris. The combined weight of the tree, easily thousands of pounds, flattened the enemy. A pair of dark forms scurried out from cover to the felled tree. The muzzle flashes illuminated down-pointing handguns and Cajuns firing point-blank into the heads of the pinned, struggling cannies. Now the cannies were tree-topping with RPGs, taking out the sniper hides one by one. The edge of the clearing was lit by burning, shattered pecan and elm. More than once, Mildred wondered where the cannies got their firepower. More than likely, a trader convoy had been overrun. From the dark forest, more shadowy figures moved low and fast. Auto fire from a hidden position swept over the invaders. Mildred couldn't see well enough to count them, but there were many. A second later, the ground shook under her stomach as a grenade explosion took out the Cajun bunker. The acrid smoke was still drifting over her, and she heard the cannies pulling the bodies out of the hold. Harvest time. Mildred and Jack saw the same opportunity in the same instant. They crawled through the leaves until they reached a wide tree trunk. Peering around it, Mildred saw the cannies bathed in weak starlight, bent over the still smoldering corpses. They were doing something to the feet, cussing them together, she guessed. When she ducked back to cover, Jack was nose to nose with her. He nodded, then they both rounded the trunk with guns up. Mildred, the last ever Olympic pistol-shooting silver medalist, had, after her cryosleep thawing, quickly picked up the knack of hitting moving flesh and blood targets. It was a matter of anticipation, of seeing a fraction of a second into the future, of seeing where the bullseye was going to be. No target could move faster than she could aim and fire. When she and Jack jumped out from behind the tree, the cannies weren't running. While the canny survivors poured slugs their way, chipping at the far side of the tree trunk with full auto fire, Mildred and Jack dumped their empties and used speed loaders to reload. They had taken down six each, but they had no way of knowing how many had gotten away or how many more had moved up to join them. One thing was clear: for Mildred and Jack to jump out again and return fire would be suicide. It was only a matter of seconds before the attackers flanked their position or one of the cannies chucked a grin their way.
We go, now!
Again, Mildred followed the albino youth. Jack turned hard left, heading back for the hillside. It was the only solid defensible cover they had. Mildred ran for all she was worth, but Jack was too quick. He pulled away from her. 10 feet, 15 feet. As he left Mildred in the dust, a canny slipping out from the woods blundered right into his path. Jack didn't slow a step, and he didn't change course. He shoved his revolver into the Flesh Eater's chest. The contact wound blew the hapless Kenny off his feet and sent him crashing onto his back in the leaves. Between them and the hillside, more RPGs detonated in the treetops. The smoke from burning cordite hung under the tree limbs like caustic fog. Jack continued to move away from Mildred. He couldn't help it. Because he could see better and run faster, he had trouble holding himself in check. As he turned, looking over his shoulder to check on her position, a rocket screamed overhead. Mildred closed the distance, lunging into the dropped limbs. She pulled the albino teen out by an arm, and she turned him on his back.
Jack! Jack! Jack!
Jack's eyes were closed, and blood oozed from a shallow wound on top of his head. She felt at his throat for a pulse, and was relieved to find a strong heartbeat. From deeper in the woods, more cannies were coming. Mildred could have picked Jack up in a fireman's carry, but she couldn't have made the hillside with him on her back. She couldn't leave him, unconscious and helpless for the cannies, even if it meant her own life. She scooped up the albino's big colt in her left hand. As flesh eaters burst through the trees, she readied her ZKR 551. Mildred had no doubt that the battle for the clearing had been lost. Through the trees to her right, Mildred saw about 25 cannies rushing for the cave mouth. Some carried RPGs. To her left, more cannies charged from cover, heading right at her. With no time to reload, Mildred whipped out her knife, straddling her fallen comrade like a mother wolf protecting its young. Before she could blink, she and Jack were surrounded by cannies. She slashed out with her knife, wheeling, keeping them at arm's length. She knew she didn't have a chance, but she was determined to send at least one more of the bastards to hell.
If we all jump her at once, we can get her.
He should have stepped back before he opened his mouth. Mildred plunged the point of her blade into his throat, driving it into the hilt, then ripping it out. As blood spurted from between his grimy fingers and jetted from between his clenched teeth, Mildred was struck in the side of the neck by a club. The blow wasn't hard enough to knock her out, but it staggered her, and she lowered her knife point. The cannies had their opening and jumped her en masse. She fought back, stabbing, kicking, punching, and elbowing. Every time she drove one of the bastards back or dropped him to his knees, another leapt forward to take his place. There were too many of them. When her strength finally faltered, the sheer weight of their bodies drove her to the ground and pinned her there. Cannies jerked her hands behind her back and tied them tightly, wrist to wrist. They tied her ankles together, too, but left a couple of feet of slack between them, which kept her from running, but not from walking. After they dragged her off Jack, one of them snatched hold of Jack's white hair and jerked up his head. The albino opened his ruby eyes.
White meat's still kicking.
Before Jack could do anything, they rolled him onto his belly, pinned him, and trussed him up the same way they had Mildred. When the canny stepped away from them, Mildred saw a familiar, scar-faced bastard bend and pick up her ZKR 551 and Jack's Colt Python. Junior Thibodeau admired the blasters briefly before tucking them into the waistband of his trousers. Mildred and Jack were hoisted to their feet as a tall man in a long duster stepped from the trees. He carried a Galil assault rifle, a folding stock, in decent condition. Hanging around his neck on a lanyard was a single-shot, exposed hammer centerfire shotgun. The rear stock had been sawed off right behind the pistol grip, and the barrel cut even with the foregrip. When the other canny stepped aside to let the tall one pass, Mildred looked at him closely. Such deference was usually shown only to a feared commander. A gray stubble covered his jaws and scalp. His high forehead was streaked with sweaty grime. Around his throat, hanging down in dozens of coils like a breastplate, was a necklace made of drilled and strung human teeth. There were hundreds of them. His lips peeled back to display a set of strong teeth of his own.
Don't just stand there. Get this meat moving.
The cannies shoved Mildred and Jack forward, forcing them deeper into the woods. In a small clearing hidden in the trees, the flesh eaters had gathered the living and the dead. 10 battered and wounded Cajun men and women stood to one side, trussed hand and ankle. In a pile on the ground in the middle of the open space were the newly slain of both sides. Some of the Cajun snipers were in pieces. A group of cannies labored over the bodies. When they saw their leader emerge from the trees, they doubled their efforts. Mildred thought she had steeled herself for the worst. She was wrong. She looked on the doings in horror and shock. These debased creatures weren't just well organized. They had reduced the handling of large numbers of cadavers to industrial, mass production simplicity. They worked in squads of three. One canny held a corpse's ankles stacked one on top of the other. A second flesh eater positioned a foot-long iron spike against the top ankle. A third drove the spike through both sets of bones and into the ground with a single slam of a sledgehammer. Long traces for dragging the body were looped around the protruding ends of the spike. They repeated the process with speed and precision until all the corpses were ready for transport. The loose body parts were then tossed into net bags, which were likewise rigged for dragging. Nothing edible went to waste. Mildred looked at Jack. Although she couldn't read his eyes, she could read the tendons jumping like cables in his neck and forearms. The wild child didn't like being tied up, and he purely hated cannies. The blood on his scalp had clotted into a dark mass.
Hurt?
Jack shook his head.
Ryan's still alive. He has to be.
The head canny waved his galil in the air.
Let's get out of here!
Some of the flesh eaters slipped their arms through the loops of the tow ropes and headed off into the forest at a trot, dragging the bodies by the ankles, face up, heads bouncing on the ground, arms trailing limply behind. The other cannies shoved the survivors into a single-file line and herded them forward with rifle butts. Walking was difficult with the short traces on their ankles. After they had traveled 100 yards or so, the cannies doing the towing lighted a dozen lanterns. Rings of white light danced and spun through the trees ahead. The cannies were less worried about being seen than in moving as fast as possible. Even with the lanterns, finding their way through the woods was problematic. Mildred puzzled over this until she walked past a luminous pale green glow stick on the ground. When she looked over her shoulder, she expected one of the cannies behind to pick up the light stick and erase the trail. When that didn't happen, Mildred felt a faint spark of hope. The trail markers were being left behind for the cave cannies. Without the markers, they wouldn't be able to find their way back to the swamp, let alone the road. If the cave cannies lost the fight, those markers would lead the Cajuns and the companions right to them. When the cannies reached the swamp, the draggers hauled the bodies in behind them. They actually made better time because the corpses floated and there was less resistance. The dozen captives and their captors plunged into the lukewarm, stagnant water, following the bobbing lanterns. Walking was difficult because they couldn't raise their feet very far with just a couple of feet of rope between their ankles. The cannies in the lead followed a trail marked by widely spaced light sticks tied to the mangroves. They hadn't gone very far when Junior Thibodeau sloshed up beside Mildred.
Smell that blood in the water, lamb chop? Feel it peckish.
Cut my hands free and I'll show you.
Nah, I don't think so. Not until the oozes come on strong. Then I'm gonna turn you loose on your friend White Meat here. Let you get your hands all messy.
Jack leered in contempt at the scar-faced canny.
What are you looking at me like that for? You think you're hot shit cause you sucker-punched me? I think it's time for a little payback.
With that, Thibodeau jumped on Jack from behind, driving him head first into the water. The canny held him under the surface, easily controlling his bound limbs. Though Jack struggled, he couldn't break free. Mildred rammed her shoulder into the canny's ribs, trying to knock him off. She couldn't get any traction in the mud, and the ankle bindings prevented her from using the power of her legs. After a brief three-way struggle, the pack leader rushed forward and broke up the attempted drowning. He grabbed hold of the back of Junior's neck, pulled him off, then hurled him into the mangrove roots.
You're slowing us down with this bullshit. We're still in Cajun territory. They could be coming up on us from behind.
Christy lay curled up in her lover's arms. Nuzzling into the side of his neck, she breathed in his familiar masculine scent. She drifted in and out of sleep, unable to slip off for long, though she was bone tired. Moments of security and peace for her and the companions were few and far between. Recuperation time measured in minutes or hours, rarely days. As Christy finally started to drift off to sleep, The sounds of running footsteps echoed from the cave entrance.
On attack from Kenny's!
At once, Ryan and Christy jumped to their feet. JB, Doc, and Spru rose from the floor, reaching for their weapons.
Where's Mildred?
Not here, apparently.
Jack's gone, too.
Torchlights bobbed down the hallway toward them.
Perhaps that is the absent pair coming.
Cheetah Luis entered the doorless chamber, flaming torch in hand. Behind him in the hallway, heavily armed men and women ran deeper into the belly of the hillside.
Come with me. Kenny's are here.
Ryan slipped the Scopestyre's sling over his shoulder.
We've got two people missing. We've got to find them first.
If they're out of the cave, they're a whole lot safer than you are. In a minute or two, this place is going to be a shooting gallery. Come on!
The Cajun waved them on with his torch. There was no time for argument, and nothing really to argue about. The Cajun was right. If Mildred and Jack were fighting Kenny's in the woods, they had room to maneuver and a damn good chance to survive.
All right, let's go.
The companions followed Cheetah Luis out of the chamber and across the cave's central corridor. Down the narrow, straight stretch of hall, Cajun men and women were running close to the left side, next to the limestone wall. At its far end, the hall bulged and widened before it dog-legged right. In front of the opening, other Cajuns were frantically pulling together a barricade of timber and rocks. From the sounds at the cave mouth, the fighters there were doing the same thing. Cheetah Luis led them into another wide, doorless chamber. The lack of doors and the large entries allowed air to circulate in the cave. In the flickering torchlight, they hurried to the back of the room and a large floor-to-ceiling bulge in the rock. The protrusion concealed a man-sized, transverse cleft in the wall, impossible to see from the doorway. The Cajun stepped into the narrow passage, and they all moved in behind him. The ceiling was high enough so that Ryan didn't have to duck his head, but the passage was hardly more than 2.5 feet wide in places, and in places, the walls were curved in an S shape. Christy had to advance sideways, scraping her hip bones and knees against the rock. Convoy Master Spru had real trouble getting through the tightest spots. Christy realized at once that the passage was bending back toward the cave entrance, running roughly parallel to the main corridor. Cheetah Luis stopped moving, bringing the line behind him to a halt.
Buddy, three Kennedys!
To Christy, it sounded as though the defenders were giving ground, letting the Kennedys penetrate their stronghold. It wasn't a happy thought.
Your fighters are pulling back mighty quick. Something wrong?
Cajuns know what to do. Now comes the fun part. Stay close.
Ryan moved right behind him. Christy had her hand on her lover's lower back. They pushed out of the side passage and into a chamber just inside the cave entrance. Light came from a few torches still burning in wall stanchions and the red flares the Kennedys had dropped. The fight continued out of sight, deep inside the hill. Outside the cave, the shooting had stopped. The silence from the woods was eerie. The Cajun tapped Doc and Spru on the shoulders with the muzzle of his M16.
You two, cover the entrance while the rest of us take care of business.
Christy, JB, and Ryan followed Cheetah Luis along the cave wall, blasters up and ready. There was no canny rear guard. Because they could see into the wide-mouthed doorless chambers, they were confident they had cleared away all opposition, eliminating the possibility of a backside attack, which was a fatal mistake. At Cheetah Luis's hand signal, Christy and JB crossed to the opposite side of the hall. Christy saw the canny attackers bunched up on either side of the entrance to the narrow section of hall. They were pouring fire on the barricade at the far end. They were disturbingly disciplined. They took turns shooting, emptying their mags, then stepping aside to let a fresh gunner blast away while they reloaded. Two Kennedys rushed from a chamber to the right of the shooters. Between them, they held a limp body by its arms. They were coming the companion's way. The Cajun held up his closed fist. Wait. Then he shifted his M16 to his left hand, and with his right, unsheathed his machete. As the Kennedys drew closer, Christy could see their victim was a woman. She could see they were grinning as they dragged her along. Cheetah Luis waited until they were practically on top of him before he struck with the machete. As Jack had said, the Cajun was a stone chiller. With a single two-handed stroke, he beheaded the nearest canny. The severed head leapt from the man's neck, hitting a wall and rolling onto the ground. Dead eyes stared upward, baffled for eternity. As the other canny opened his mouth to cry for help, Ryan swung his punga crossways. The razor-sharp blade split open the canny's face. Ryan ripped the blade out, then forehand slashed under the scraggly chin beard, driving the blade through the front of his throat. The canny's head flopped over, spear resting on shoulder, blood sheeting from the massive neck wound. While Christy and JB covered them, Ryan and Cheetah Louise drag all three bodies into the nearest chamber, out of sight. Meanwhile, the Canny's rain of bullets had beaten the defenders back around the hallway's bend. Seizing the opportunity, the Flesh Eaters leapfrog down the narrow stretch of corridor, keeping up a one-sided stream of automatic fire. Cheetah Louise and the companions dashed forward to take up the positions the Canny's had just abandoned. The Flesh Eaters broke and ran the last 30 feet, charging the barricade. A wide section of the cave floor gave way under their combined weight. In the blink of an eye, a dozen Canny's disappeared down the dust-belching hole.
Now!
Cheetah Louise stepped out from cover and opened up full auto with his M16. The massed fire scattered bodies the width of the corridor. As Cheetah Louise and the companions rushed forward, Cajun fighters appeared around the bend, then jumped the barricade. Christy looked down over the edge of the pit trap, over the ends of the buckled and splintered cover that stuck up from the hole. Canny men and women lay 15 feet down, impaled on multiple rows of 2-inch thick, 4-foot long greenwood spikes. The spikes had punched through necks, chests, limbs, and bowels. Some tried to pull themselves free, raising up on the gore-greased poles, only to lose their grip and fall, skewering themselves even deeper. Cheetah Louise watched, grinning as the Flesh Eaters struggled in their own mess. He paused to light up another fat ganja stick and suck down the pungent, potent smoke. In the torchlight, his eyeballs looked pink, his eyelids drooped to slits. The Cajun stripped away his M16 spent mag, inserted a full one. They weren't dying fast enough to suit him.
Gillimore!
From both sides of the pit, the Cajuns opened fire, streaming hot lead into the defenseless, dying Cannies. Heads exploded and bellies burst open from close-range, full-auto hits. Even the bastards who were already dead were bullet-chewed to hamburger. When the Cajuns were done, the floor of the pit was awash in spilled blood and guts. The companions didn't participate in the grotesque coup de grace, nor did Sprue. It seemed a waste of time and good ammo, not to mention the splatter factor. Cheetah Louise led his fighters and the companions back to the cave entrance. The Cajuns were buoyed by their success, not exuberant, but charged. It didn't last. As they filtered out into the Louisiana night, their mood changed in a hurry. An unnatural quiet hung over the woods. At the edge of the clearing, tree trunks had been blown apart by high explosives. Dropped branches littered the ground. Some were still burning. There were no bodies, Canny or Cajun. And Mildred and Jack were nowhere in sight.
How many did we lose?
Could be more than 20. We had almost that many sentries set out, and some of our folk ran out of the cave to fight in the woods.
Kenny's tracked us all the way from the road. That's where they'll be heading back to.
Someone stumbled through the brush.
Hold it! It's one of ours!
A wounded man staggered forward. Then fell. The Cajuns and their guests rushed to his side. Christy grimaced at the bloody bullet hole. It was low in his belly. A gutbuster. Cheetah Louise knelt over the fallen fighter.
What happened to the others?
Canny's took them all. The living and the dead. Dragged off into the swamp.
Did you see the live prisoners? Did you see them get taken away?
The dying man nodded, but as he did so, his eyes fluttered shut. And his chest stopped heaving.
He's checking out on us.
Not yet.
Ryan leaned down and grabbed hold of the man's chin. When he squeezed hard, digging in his fingertips, the fighter opened his eyes wide.
Did you see a black woman and a pale-skinned man? Were they taken prisoner?
Canis took them both. Man in bad shape.
Cheetah Louise stared down at the dead Cajun fighter as Ryan slowly rose to his feet. Ryan could sense the headman's sputtering fury. It came off him in almost tangible waves. He was like a fragrant about to blow. Because of all the pain, all the loss he'd witnessed and suffered, Cheetah Louise was a couple hundred miles around the bend of sanity. But the Cajun didn't explode. He'd learned to use the power of his rage, to shape it, to wield it like a splitting maul, which didn't make him any less dangerous, or any less crazy. He turned to Lila, his chunky female lieutenant, The extinguished ganja stick clenched between his teeth.
I want a head count. I want to know exactly who's here and who's gone.
As she moved to do his bidding, Cheetah Louise flicked away his cigarette. His eyes were unfocused, his expression fixed with abject hatred. He was lost in a waking dream of blood and death, sorrow and guilt. This was the downside to staking a claim in Deathlands, to putting down roots in anticipation of some kind of an unfolding future. Roots, by their nature, limited action and mobility. Offense automatically became defense. And in the end, if you were committed to die for a piece of dirt, not even 100 seasoned fighters could ensure success, short or long term. The hellscape was wicked devious. It unleashed wave after wave of constantly shifting attacks until it found or created a soft spot. Lila returned a few minutes later, her weathered face pale with shock.
It's worse than we thought. Close to half our folks are missing.
What? You sure?
I counted twice.
The other Cajuns listened in dead silence. These were people accustomed to grief, to chilling, but not to a defeat like this. They looked gutshot.
We have to cut off the head, no matter what it costs. None of us stands a chance if we don't chill that canny queen. Whether the stuff about the power of her blood is true or not, she's the one in charge. She organized all this shit.
Fucking Freezy.
Face it, Luis. This La Golondrina hit the ground running. Who knows who or what she was before the apocalypse, but she knew what she wanted when she got here, and she knew damn well how to make it happen. No other canny before her has done what she's done. No other canny will do it after she's dead. If we take her out, the flesh-eaters will fall back to their old ways, hunting in small packs, dog-eat-dog, making their living by picking off the weak and the stupid. That's something we can deal with, just like we always have.
Cheetah Louise stared at Ryan for a moment.
I've worked hard to keep it together here, to keep the fighters focused, keep them on the offensive. That's what we Cajuns do best. You push, we push back harder. It's in our nature. What happened tonight is my fault. I should have planned better. I should have seen it coming. I thought we had it covered.
You can't plan for everything. In war, shit always happens.
Time to get some shit on the other end of the stick.
Cheetah Louise waved his people closer.
Half of our people have been taken for caney meat. Either chilled or prisoners. Some of our best fighters are gone. Up until now, our hit-and-get tactics worked smooth because we had plenty of folks to control our chill zones. When we struck, we overwhelmed the enemy with firepower. We left no survivors. Now, our numbers are cut by half. We can't replace any of the people we lost, which means we got to run smaller, much riskier ops. And to do the same damage to the bastards, we have to run a whole lot more of them. If we do that, the odds are stacked against us. It won't be long before the caney bastards grind us down and shoot us out. That's the only future I can see if we don't seize the moment now. If we don't take the fight to the queen, bitch. That way, at least if we go out, we go out in a blaze.
His speech didn't bring cheers or shouts of enthusiasm from his audience. Sugar-coated suicide was just that. But his logic was irrefutable. Grim-faced, the Cajuns nodded.
Gather up all the ammo and pipe bombs you can carry. Bring the lanterns, too. The Canis are going to be hobbled hauling the dead and the prisoners. We'll run them down.
The Cajuns really hustled. In a matter of minutes, pursuit was underway through the woods. Ryan, Christy, JB, Doc, and Sprue ran in the middle of the strung-out pack. Progress stopped when they came across the first light stick tacked to a tree.
This is how the bastards found their way out. How they got in is another story.
Lila tore the luminescent stick from the trunk.
These will burn out soon, but even burned out, the Canis could use them to find their way back in daylight. Should we pick them up as we go? When we get enough gathered, we could send runners to start moving them way off to the west, make a false trail deeper into the swamp. Canis would never find our stronghold again. Find nothing but gators and snakes.
No point in that. We ain't coming back here, no matter what. Either we take over Marsh Island by daybreak, or we're going to be somebody's beacon.
The question of how the Cannies found their way in was answered a short distance farther on. Lanterns illuminated crude cut marks on tree trunks.
These are fresh.
Somebody tracked us here from the road. Left these signs behind for the others to follow.
The convoy and Kanes were too far away to catch up and find our trail.
He turned to Ryan.
Maybe that pet flesh eater of yours did the job.
It was exactly what Ryan was thinking. Junior Thibodeau had doubled back on them.
We should have tracked a bastard when he ran off.
Again, exactly what Ryan was thinking.